I know everybody, this town wants to argue about gun control. I don't think it what will work.
What meds are you on?
Me? None. I used to be on lithium and Seroquel and Abilify, but I don't take them anymore. No. They make me foggy and they also make me bloated.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio? Proof that some men are inferior.
Clips from Lincoln, a clip from Silver Lining, two of the movies we'll be talking about a little later in the hour. You heard Wayne LaPierre at the top there talking about gun control, the head of the NRA. We're going to take a look at the science and the history of gun control science right now on Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Thank you for joining us. In the debate about gun control facts and statistics, well, what's true, what's not true, how has research been conducted? Dr. Frederick P. Rivara is a professor and vice chair in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington. Also, sir, a long list of things you do. Seattle Children's Guild endowed chair in pediatrics?
Yes.
Professor and vice chair, Department of Pediatrics? Division chief, general pediatrics, University of Washington? You've done a lot of work.
Yes, I'm a busy guy.
And editor in chief of the Journal of American Medical Association, Pediatrics.
Correct.
You must see gun control studies come across your desk as editor of that publication.
Actually, no, we don't.
And that's the point. What's happened?
Well, I actually was very involved with gun control research back in the late 80s and early 90s, and we conducted studies like comparing Seattle to Vancouver in British Columbia and showing that the homicide rate and suicide rate here in Seattle was much higher than in Vancouver, and solely because of guns.
And you could make the studies showed that was the factor, gun accessibility.
We showed that there was a big difference in homicides and suicide rates in Seattle and Vancouver. We know are pretty similar cities, but they have very different policies on guns. In Vancouver, it's very difficult to have a gun, and particularly having a gun at home. Well, we know in the state of Washington, that's not the case.
I mean, you hesitated, and I asked because that's what gun control opponents will often say. Look, you cannot draw conclusions from access to use.
Well, that may be somewhat true. But the point of it is, as you started at the beginning of the hour here, is there actually has not been very much research in gun control in the last, or gun safety in the last 15, 20 years. And the reason is that in 1996, after those studies and some other studies that we and others did that were funded by the Centers for Disease Control, a federal agency, 10 senators from Congress threatened to cut off all funding for the injury research program at the CDC. They didn't succeed in doing that, but they did end up cutting the budget of the injury program by $2.6 million, which was the exact amount that they were spending on gun research.
And this is where gun research is conducted. This is sort of the top level by which it's encouraged throughout the country.
That was correct. But then what they did is they also put into the appropriations for the CDC some language that effectively forbid gun research.
How do they do that? I mean,
They put a rider on the appropriations bill. Well, they said that no government funds could be used to advocate or lobby for gun control, which, of course, that we can't lobby, use federal funds, state dollars to lobby for anything. But the net effect was that the Centers for Disease Control stopped funding gun research.
Because it was seen that research equated with lobbying?
Seemed that research equated with knowing something. And that, policymakers should have evidence. They should have scientific information to make decisions. But in fact, they didn't want that evidence to be accumulated. And then in 2011, that same legislation was also extended to the NIH. So effectively, there's been a suppression of any research on gun safety, gun violence. Now, we know that some things may not need research, but we also know that there are a lot of questions that remain unanswered. I mean, however many of us might disagree with Wayne LaPierre last Friday, we actually don't know whether having more guns in the community would actually improve safety or not.
How would you study that?
Well, we could compare communities where there are more guns to those where there are fewer guns, compare places of business where there are more guns to places where there are fewer guns, and see what are the differences. It's the same kind of way we looked at Seattle compared to Vancouver. Places that have more guns found out that they actually had higher rates of homicide and suicide.
What else is missing, do you think, in terms of just knowledge we need to understand gun issues?
Well, I mean, you, and if you saw the piece in New York Times this morning about the ATF, there is in the front page of New York Times a story this morning about how the ATF really doesn't have the computerized database that police can tap into rapidly to find out what's the sort of source of a gun. And that, again, is due to legislative actions by Congress. We did some studies in the university a number of years ago using the state gun registry database to find out, again, are homes where there are guns more likely to have homicides or suicides than homes which aren't. We found that that was the case. We're unable to access that database anymore.
Where did it go?
It's there, but you can't access it. And actually, after we wrote the editorial, I found out that actually in the Obamacare bill, the Accountable Care Act, there's actually a piece in there put in by Harry Reid that's called the Protection of Second Amendment Rights that actually forbids me as a physician of writing down anything about whether or not there is a gun in a home.
Does it go further than that? And does the Affordable Care Act have some other stipulations to prevent any funding or focusing on gun violence?
It doesn't. But then one of the things we mentioned in our editorial and one of the things we published this month in the Archives of Pediatrics, the JAMA Pediatrics, was an article by pediatricians in Florida where there's a gag law that was put in by the legislature and signed by the governor that prevents me as a pediatrician, if I was working in Florida, from asking a parent whether there might be somebody mentally ill at home, whether or not there's a gun in the home.
Dr. Frederick P. Rivara is one of the authors of Silencing the Science on Gun Research at the Journal of the American Medical Association. What kind of response have you gotten to this article? It's only been, it's been online for a few days.
For a few days. We've gotten a very positive response. I think that it is, we've been commented that it was actually a very reasonable approach. It doesn't call for gun control. It really calls for us finding out more information about what works and what doesn't work. We have obviously gotten a few negative letters as well, but that's to be expected.
There's an implication in what you're writing and in the actions taken that the proponents of gun control feel that research will prove that gun control should be extended.
I don't want to speak for them. I feel like we know that research has made a difference. We know that it's helped in healthcare and medicine. We know that deaths, for example, from motor vehicle injuries over the last 20 years have declined by more than a third. Deaths from fires have declined by more than a third. Deaths from drownings have declined by more than half. Yet the number of gun deaths has really stayed about flat at about 31,000 gun deaths a year in the United States. We happen to think that research is one of the things that helps to make people safer and healthier in their lives.
I am. You mentioned that the language was put in the bill and here in your editorial. None of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. You could design. I mean, the implication is that studies on gun control always turn into advocacy or promotion for gun control. I guess you could say studies on gun use, gun safety. That's the implication that I get, but you don't have to speak for them.
I feel that science should speak for itself. Science should be used to inform public policymakers or legislators. Are the legislators saying they really don't want to know what's the truth?
That's what it reads like. Where do we know who are the 10 senators? Who are 10 congressmembers? Do you have them in your mind?
I have a few of them in my mind. One was Senator Trent Locke, who's no longer in the Senate, Bob Dole, and Richard Shelby, who is still in the Senate from Alabama.
Now, have you in your work, have you looked and see what kind of funding or support they get from gun lobby groups?
I haven't.
Where is research being done on gun safety and gun violence in the world?
There's very little. There is a policy center at Johns Hopkins University. There is some funding from the Joyce Foundation based out of Chicago, but it's really very little research on guns being done in the United States.
And the rest of the world?
No. because the rest of the world doesn't have this problem.
Or they've already,
the world is a lot saner than we are.
They've already looked at their science. They must have done research at some point across the years.
Well, I think they've looked at some of ours, but they never, ever had the gun problem that we had here in the United States. I mean, you know, it's interesting that in that same terrible Friday where it was the deaths of those 20 children in Newtown, Connecticut, there was in a newspaper report from China where a man stabbed 20 school children. They all lived.
Yeah. Well, I had a conversation with a gun control opponent, a gun rights advocate, who argued that it's not the weapon, it's the person, and that we should focus on mental illness, and it's not the gun that kills, it's the person who pulls the trigger.
Well, I think we all agree that there needs to be better mental health care in the United States. Having access to mental health care is not easy. But we find it pretty difficult to screen everyone, to identify those people who end up going on rampages. And we can't prevent all of that from happening, but I think we can prevent mass killings by having some sort of better control on the kinds of weapons that are available for people that are mentally unhinged.
Now, according to the article, there are types of studies that you wrote as the editorial. There were types of studies that were conducted but cannot be conducted today using federal dollars or some of these dollars. Association between purchase of a handgun and the subsequent risk of homicide or suicide. So we're not studying that. We don't know that. Examining whether or not carrying a gun increases or decreases the risk of firearm assault. But you had some studies on that were done in 2009 through the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism.
Charlie Brannis from the University of Pennsylvania conducted a study showing that where people seemed to be carrying guns, they were actually more likely to be assaulted and killed than people that don't carry guns. And it was after that study that this prohibition on using guns for using federal dollars for gun research was extended to the NIH.
I see. Well, I can see why. If you're proving that it sort of goes against what Wayne LaPierre just said, the only thing that stands between a bad guy and a gun is a good guy and a gun.
It's up to Mr. LaPierre.
But the study showed that a good guy with a gun or a person with a gun may end up involved in more assaults, altercations, et cetera.
My co-author, Dr. Arthur Kellerman, was here at the University of Washington many years ago, and he conducted a study with Don Ray, the former medical examiner. And they showed that for every time the people who have guns in a home, for every time they're actually able to defend themselves and shoot an intruder, there are 43 people in the home that are killed with guns through homicides, suicides, or accidental gunshot shootings.
When was that done?
That was done in, I think, 1987.
How easy access to firearms mitigates or amplifies both the likelihood and consequences of violence. That study falls under that aspect that's no longer studied. Well, what needs to be done?
Well, I think that the people listening here can write to their congressman and ask them, why is there still this prohibition on gun research? Why don't we want to know what works and what doesn't work? I think we need to keep up the pressure on Congress to really address this issue. I'm not saying we should have gun control. I'm saying that we really need to tackle this issue intelligently, thoughtfully, and with science behind us to guide those decisions.
Any sign from – I mean, I understand that the JAMA magazine is not necessarily going to be getting all sorts of public input. But any signs that what happened two weeks ago is changing that notion, that Congress members are speaking out more. I mean, we see it. But again, I talked to a gun control advocate who said – a gun rights advocate who said, oh, that's just politicians covering themselves and they'll go back to knowing where their money comes from in a few months.
You know, that's been true in the past. We've had episodes like this, Columbine, the Aurora shootings. There's been initial outrage for a day or two and then it's died away. I do happen to think that this was so horrific that it is a game changer, and that Congress, when they come back from recess, will not be able to continue business as usual when it comes to guns. I hope that Vice President Biden's committee will make some strong recommendations that then will be pushed by both the President and Congress.
I mean, that would, sounds like what you're saying is that would be one of the most useful first steps, is just to remove that restriction and focus some scientific research on guns in America.
As a scientist, I believe that that's really important.
Dr. Frederick P. Rivara is professor and vice chair in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington, Silencing the Science on Gun Research in the Journal of American Medical Association. It's a link at KUOW.org, and thank you for coming in on your days off to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me here today.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:20. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. We have cloudy skies and 43 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high getting up to the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight as well, the low in the mid-30s.
Support for KUOW comes from United Way of King County, thanking those who give, volunteer, and change the game for people in need at the holidays and all through the year. More at unitedwayofkingcounty.org. Live United.
No more Christmas headaches. For the day after Christmas, a whole hour looking at the latest science and the latest excitement over what we're learning about the human brain.
When we learn to read, we are literally making an entirely new circuit in our brain.
Reboot with us next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
And that comes your way this afternoon at 1 o'clock. What was the best movie of 2012? We'll pose that question to film critic Robert Horton and get your pick coming up in 10 minutes.
Now look at Northwest author Jess Walter. He brings to life 1960s Italy and contemporary Hollywood in his latest novel, Beautiful Ruins. On the one hand, a sprawling novel told from a handful of viewpoints spanning multiple decades. At its heart, Beautiful Ruins is a simple story. One man sets out to find out what happened to a woman he fell in love with 50 years earlier. I asked Jess Walter about the Italian village where the book begins.
Yeah, it's set in a village I invented called Porta Vergogna, Port of Shame. I was in the Cinque Terre in 1997 with my wife, and I just fell in love with these villages etched into the cliff face of the Ligurian Sea, and it just always seemed like the most beautiful, exotic place to set a novel. But I wanted my own village, you know, with my own sort of idea of what the place would be. So I invented a sixth town, Porta Vergogna, with its hotel, the Hotel Adequate View, and I put this young man, Pasquale Tursi, there in this town that you could only reach by boat, and then set the fictional wheels rolling, and 15 years later, I had a novel.
15 years later?
Yeah, I mean, I hate when authors say, I spent 15 years on this book, because you imagine them in a room for 15 years, and I wrote five other novels in the meantime, and worked on scripts, and had, you know, dealings in Hollywood, and wrote a million other things, but I would always come back to this book and these characters, and I finished it once in 2008, but, you know, it had grown by then into a story about storytelling. The beautiful ruins of the title also meant the kind of artifacts that made up the book, a bit of a play, and part of a movie pitch, and a memoir. And all of those things, I mean, putting those pieces together was the real work of the novel. And so in 2008, I went back to Italy, went back to the Cinque Terre, and just spent some time ruminating. It was almost like the characters came with me because I'd been with them so long. And then when I went back to the novel, it was with a real sense of clarity of how this structure should come together in the end, and hopefully a real payoff.
Did you do a lot of pairing? Was it a much longer novel the first time you finished it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's such an inevitability about a finished book. You see it and you think, well, that was always meant to be. But, you know, if they did outtakes like they do at the end of movies, you know, you'd see a chapter in which in postmodernist fury, I put myself in the book pitching a movie at one time. And you'd see, you know, chapters about characters who have just been completely excised. So, yeah, and in a way, this is atypical of my books because they've usually taken me 2 or 3 years. But in a way, it's typical, too, in that I think an author hits about what a good hitting baseball player does. So I hit about 30% of what I write ends up in the book.
Yeah, and to be that successful.
Yeah, I mean,
that'd be a fine success rate.
It would, actually. Yeah,
too.
Yeah. Like a Mariner author would hit about 240.
Oh!
So, yeah. That's the ballpark. It's not their fault.
Yeah, that's right. It's the ballpark. Sometimes writers say, oh, you know, you don't finish it the first time, leave it behind.
Yeah.
What kept you coming back to this?
Well, and I do have stories I've left behind. You know, every time I went back to it, I tore it back from the beginning. I started from page one, so it was a brand new novel. I heard a painter one time say, sometimes I go back to a painting and the paint's just dry. There's nothing I can do. Every time I went back to this, I felt like the paint wasn't dry. I felt like these characters were still, you know, animated and doing something. As I worked through it, the novel, as I said, became about storytelling. I wanted to put some of my satirical ideas about Hollywood in there. So I think every time I went back to it, the novel grew into something different, and yet those characters remained at the heart of it.
Somebody, one reviewer wrote, if this book were being pitched to Warner Brothers, it would be boiled down to Il Postino meets the player.
Well, thank goodness it's not being pitched that way. But yeah.
Well, that's part of what you write about in
right.
this book.
Yeah,
I suppose
it's fair to break it down to the Hollywood pitch since Hollywood plays such a role in it.
Yeah, describe your character, Claire. And then I want you to read
sure.
the description of her boss.
Yeah, Claire is, I've had experiences in Hollywood that are incredibly cynical. I will go to these meetings in which I can't believe what we're talking about. And
do you have an example, by the way?
Yeah, sure. You know, the Financial Lives of the Poets, my last book, which is about a newspaper reporter who's you know, on his way out of the middle class. He's losing his house. His wife may be cheating on him. And it's a comic novel, and I wrote the script for it. And I remember talking to one producer at one time who's like, no, it's great. I love it. But, you know, the guy's such a loser. What if he was a winner? What if instead he was, say, a lawyer? And I looked at him like, well, that would be a different movie, you know? And then, and his wife, you describe her as, you know, she had kids and now she's not as attractive. What if she's even hotter? What if she's really attractive? And, you know, the idea that everything's malleable and pliable and, you know, has always cracked me up. At the end of that book, you know, he loses a lot. He loses his house, loses some things. And this producer couldn't imagine that. He said, you know, how can you have something where he loses all his stuff? And I said, well, that's the, you know, kind of the point. And he said, well, it's not a happy ending if you lose your stuff. So he, you know, couldn't imagine it. But yeah, all of those things.
Wait, what, didn't he come to some sort of understanding about his life at the end of
I think, I think to them, without your stuff, there is no understanding of life.
Well, I understand that. Yeah. But, I mean, I can see how they would think that.
Yeah, yeah. But Claire is sort of reflects for me the two moods that I always have down there. I have this cynicism. I think, boy, this, you know, how does anything good come out of this? But also this strange hopefulness. I mean, movies are a kind of generational religion for us. You can close your eyes and summon up a scene from your favorite movie more powerfully than you can most of your memories. And so, and I keep being drawn, you know, the Financial Lives of the Poets ended up with a great director, Michael Winterbottom, a British director, attached to it. And once again, I'm hopeful. And so Claire works in Hollywood and sort of balances those. She works for the most cynical producer you could imagine, this guy named Michael Dean, who I've invented. And Claire is...
I don't know. The way you describe him, he must be somebody you've seen.
No. I guess he's a composite, you know, if an exaggeration in a composite. So.
Well, read your description.
Sure. This is Michael Dean. The first impression one gets of Michael Dean is of a man constructed of wax, or perhaps prematurely embalmed. After all these years, it may be impossible to trace the sequence of facials, spa treatments, mud baths, cosmetic procedures, lifts and staples, collagen implants, outpatient touch-ups, tannings, Botox injections, cyst and growth removals, and stem cell facial injections that have caused a 72-year-old man to have the face of a 9-year-old Filipino girl. Trying to picture what Michael Dean looked like as a young man in Italy 50 years ago, based on his appearance now, is like standing on Wall Street trying to understand the topography of Manhattan Island before the Dutch arrived.
Jess Walter reading a description in his book, Beautiful Ruins. He just, I, you know, reading that, I think about some of the actors I see portraying. I mean, they're often cast portraying agents or producers.
Yeah, right.
And there is that look about them. You must see a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
Hollywood.
Well, I mean, not just in.
Not just in Hollywood.
I mean, that I was doing a reading in San Francisco, and I, with a slightly older crowd, and I saw a couple of people wince when I got into the description of plastic surgery. But yeah, and to be fair, I mean, Michael Dean, I think. Is almost a kind of dark hero of the book. You know, his sort of view of the culture, I think, is the one that has become predominant, sort of wins over.
Yeah, to not be cynical.
Right. To just keep moving forward. I describe him as a shark who just keeps swimming straight ahead, looking for the next meal.
But not an always destructive shark?
No. And in fact, you know, the heart of the book is this guy, Pasquale Tursi, who meets this actress, Dee Murray, who's been exiled from the movie Cleopatra with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. And his quest to find her 50 years later, Michael Dean, is the man who brings them back together without giving away too much.
By the way, the other character that is at the office the same time Pasquale's there, is a sort of a failed writer.
Spender,
pitching a story. Shane.
Exactly.
Are you making fun of yourself there?
You know, I was sort of that hopeful desire. He's pitching a movie that I don't think I would be dim enough to try to pitch. He's in trying to get the studio to make Donner with an exclamation point.
It's not about the cannibalism.
Yeah, it's not about the cannibalism. Only it's kind of about the cannibalism. Yeah. When I would tell people, what's your new book about? It's, it's about, you know, a 50-year love affair, Hollywood and cannibalism. They would think I was exaggerating, but. It's kind of what it's about.
I don't know. I think that movie could get made.
Yeah, it probably could. I'll pitch it. Yeah, it's Donner meets Il Postino.
Well, you talk in there about reality TV,
yeah.
and how it's affecting the creative juices,
yeah,
sure. of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way? I mean, are you watching that as an observer or somebody also?
Yeah,
interacts.
I've had no involvement in reality TV. You can't blame that on me. But I don't think, you know, I don't think that the entertainment industry feeds us something. I mean, I think it reflects the culture back to us. And I think, and that's one of the things I try to write about in the book, is I think we're at a place now where celebrity is so ingrained in us. Everyone who has their own Facebook page is their own publicist. They put a picture of themselves up. You know, I've never seen anyone put the bad news up about them on Facebook, unless it's to get sympathy. You know, it's only, you know, it's a kind of small publicity mill we're creating about ourselves. And it used to be a time when a band sold out and self-promoted too much, they immediately lost whatever cultural cool they had. I think it's impossible to sell out now because that's our baseline. And so that it was a lot of my fiction is really on the social satire level.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, what I wanted to do in this book is trace what I felt like was the beginning of this moment when celebrity became not just accepted, but became almost part of our DNA strand.
That's Jess Walter, the Spokane writer and author of 5 novels, including his latest, Beautiful Ruins. Weekday's book commentator Nancy Pearl told us last week that she considers Beautiful Ruins to be one of the best books of this entire year. That's why we ran that conversation again on Monday. We're going to pick a whole bunch of interviews that we did over this past year and bring you 2012 in review through some of the people we talked to. I hope you'll be there for that. Coming up, best movies of the year. I hope you'll be there for that with your suggestions.
We have clouds and rain, 44 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast calls for clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. Clouds and rain tonight as well, the low in the mid-30s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow with a chance of rain. Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
Next time on The World, a pair of musicians from Poland who built their own glass harp. They built it from 60 drinking glasses, large and small, which they play together.
At the beginning, it was just a physical experiment, not musical.
And it was like a musical joke, you know. We didn't treat it very serious.
5 Octaves in Glass, next time on The World.
That story and much more today at 4, over on our second program service, KUOW2.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Area Whole Foods Markets, presenting Bag Hunger, a charitable event taking place throughout this holiday season with proceeds directed toward local nonprofit Solid Ground, November 28th until December 31st. More information at wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:34.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat. the popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy, the chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Ah, for those of you who are used to just hearing that song in the second hour on Wednesdays, a treat for you. And I hope you are here to help us decide our list for the best movies of the year. And clearly, our list is not going to be 10, and it won't even be complete, and nobody will agree. Because I've just been pulling teeth out of Robert Horton, film critic for the Herald and Everett, to give me 10. It took a while just to get 10 from you.
You know, There's funny things about making lists, which is, of course, absurd and all that stuff, and we'll just, you know, acknowledge that. But we have to decide whether we're talking about movies that opened, that were minted in 2012 in some kind of official capacity. Like they showed, they had a week that they played in New York and Los Angeles to qualify for awards season, for instance. Or are we talking about movies that opened in the Puget Sound area in 2012, which can be kind of different, but they came to us for the first time then. We, most of us, didn't get a chance to see them before that. So that's why it's sometimes I'm thinking, well, did this movie, I'm giving you this, you know.
That's why I'm arguing you should just do films, since you write for the Herald and Everett, you should just do films that opened in Snohomish County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take that under advisement.
They have some big multiplexes up there, don't they? They open a lot of big films.
They most certainly do.
Yeah, up there. It's nice of me, up there.
Up there, way up there.
Yeah, right. We're all in this world together.
We, yes.
In, out, up, down. So we asked folks to post on Facebook, see what kind of comments we'll get there. We're gonna ask more from you to post on Facebook. We're also going to take your calls. You'll have to make the case. Robert is a harsh taskmaster on that. Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. On Facebook, it's a weekday on KUOW. Search for that. You'll find it. There's our comment list. Kristen wrote, "A safety not guaranteed. Was excellent. It could have been trite, but instead it was beautiful, awkward, and surprising." Don't know it.
It was a film that was actually shot in Seattle.
Ah.
Or in their hereabouts. Yeah, locally.
All right. Rick Friel, "Easily it was Cabin in the Woods. My wife and I are huge horror fans. Good artist taking horror to the next level. Anyone else see it?" You see it?
I certainly did, yes. And I had a good time with that movie, actually, because it's a very postmodern approach to the horror movie, in which all of the usual conventions of a horror film are kind of taken apart and sort of made fun of. And then it gets really weird and in a very imaginative sort of way.
All right. We like these segments because we get to play clips from movies.
I see. Okay.
That's how we roll.
Yeah.
Here in the radio land.
Well, let's see what you got.
We got a little bit of the Steven Spielberg Lincoln.
"How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio? Proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George. So low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you."
How dare you?
That's Tommy Lee Jones.
It could only be Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah.
Like Thaddeus Stevens arguing for the 13th Amendment in the House. That's a long, long cry from my esteemed colleague, maybe misunderstanding my intentions.
If only they were a little more direct these days, as someone might be then.
All right, where's Lincoln rank in your film pantheon?
Well, it's on there. It's on there. That made my top 10 list, right about the middle of the list, I would say.
Right about the middle.
Yeah. You can hear in that clip some of the work of Tony Kushner, the playwright who worked on who authored the final screenplay of Lincoln, and it is a very literate film, and it's a joy to listen to as well as watch, partly for that reason. And I think wisely, unlike so many biopics that sort of stretch out in ungainly fashion, Lincoln concentrates on basically a month in the life of not just Lincoln, not just the man who is the 16th president of the United States, but also the life of Washington, D.C., as the 13th Amendment is being argued and debated and voted on. I think that was a really wise move to concentrate all of your energy, storytelling energy, on this one chapter of Lincoln's life.
I read a David Denby review for my prep in New Yorker of Lincoln, and he was quoting another critic whose name I'm forgetting now, who was complaining that, who felt that, well, you know, to focus on Lincoln as the person who helped end slavery debases the efforts of the slaves who rose up as the Union armies were marching through and the armies themselves. And Denby's argument was, well, you know, it still needed a leader in Washington to force it through as a constitutional amendment, because otherwise people would have backslid, and Andrew Johnson, given his reality and the returning Southerners into Congress, would have diluted efforts to get rid of slavery if it hadn't been a constitutional amendment. And I thought that was a telling moment, because that is, of course, what presidents and leaders can do. Be pivotal.
I think so. There's certainly, I mean, there's also this big debate outside the film, not predating the film by a long margin, about whether we should be talking about history as being stories of the great men or taking this more macro view of it, I guess. So maybe that original comment was coming from that place. I don't know. But it's, you know, you can even look at the fact that if Lincoln hadn't been murdered, how things might have been different for the South, for race, for all kinds of things. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the movie is that Lincoln is not on screen for, I don't know, 40% of the film, maybe, even though it's named after him. So it is about this process, and it's about all the people who are involved in making these pieces fit here and there. But it does need this person who makes a decision at the top that this is going to happen now rather than some other time.
So as a film, that's pretty interesting too, isn't it? That Thaddeus Stevens, that Mary Todd Lincoln, that they're important characters and fleshed out.
Yeah, and even the people who are the kind of underlings who run around trying to flatter and bribe might not be a nice word, but basically cajole certain members of Congress into voting certain ways. You spend a lot of time with them as well. So it's a process movie, and really interesting for that.
So let's not forget Lincoln as the new movie starts sweeping by. Daniel Day-Lewis, he'll be nominated, right?
Yeah.
All right.
He's pretty darn good.
All right. I'll tell you what. Here's another clip. This is from Silver Lining Playbook.
What meds are you on?
Me? None. I used to be on lithium and Seroquel and Abilify, but I don't take them anymore. No. They make me foggy, and they also make me bloated.
Yeah. I was on Xanax and Effexor, but I agree, it wasn't as sharp, so I stopped.
You ever take Klonopin?
Klonopin, yeah.
Right?
Jesus.
Like, is it what?
Yeah.
What day is it? How about Trazodone?
Trazodone?
Oh, it flattens you out. I mean, you are done. It takes the light right out of your eye.
God, I bet it does.
That's Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence discussing their history of medication in this film, a film that you really liked.
Yes, I do. I think it's a terrific movie. That's a typically kind of screwball comedy sort of first date there between those two people and what they talk about 21st century style, I guess. It's a movie about two people who are damaged in ways that the film takes seriously and, in fact, shows. When I started watching this movie, I thought, oh, no, this is not going to be a movie about where it takes people who are struggling with some form of mental illness, Bradley Cooper's character in particular, and kind of glossing it over or making a joke out of it or suggesting that, gee, we'd all be healthier if we just stopped taking medication and so on. And the movie is not any of those things. And it shows some of the fallout, some of the very serious violence, for that matter, that can come from uncomfortable and unstable situations. But it also is this comedy, and it's kind of a romance, and it's about a family and a community in some ways beyond that. And it's a giddy film at times, just in a way that so many movies that are ostensibly released as comedies never even come close to, just kind of a joyful quality.
I like that.
Yeah. And it comes down to a dance contest that these two people enroll in, and they're terrible. They're not good dancers, and that becomes part of the pleasure of the finale is that they're just aiming to be mediocre. If they can just hit this level of mediocrity, they will have achieved what they want. And there's something kind of awesome about that, especially in movies that, you know, we're always taught to go for the gold ring and you got to be the best of the best. And this is just has a delightful quality to it that I think is kind of infectious.
So Bradley Cooper emerging as a serious actor from his Hangover and his other work. I mean, whenever I saw him, I thought, oh, yeah, the guy's going to be like a Paul Martin Thomas.
who is this Paul Martin Thomas?
No, what's his name? The guy in the guy
you
in
mean
Fast.
Thomas Martin Paul.
Tom, if you have three first names, you're good. No, yeah. The guy in the Fast and the Furious. Anyways, not Vin Diesel.
Yeah, not Vin Diesel.
That's what I mean.
Well,
but he's not. He's more than that. He's got some acting chops.
He does. He certainly does in this film. I mean, I never took him that seriously myself, and I never thought there was anything in particular there. And yet, he's really solid in this movie. And Jennifer Lawrence is. Better than that.
She's always really solid. All right. There's a couple of movies. We're getting your list of some of your favorite films, too, your suggestions. Send it. Put them on Weekday on KUOW Facebook page. Email us, weekday at KUOW. Give us a call. Weigh in, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. What were some of the best movies of this past year? What should we see? No, not miss? You would say, first of all, I'm going to go down your list. This is not a film.
Yes. I know that I think we talked about this when it came out. A film made by the imprisoned Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi, brilliant filmmaker. He made the film before he was thrown in prison, but while he was under house arrest. And obviously he made it under very minimal circumstances. But I'm not including it because, you know, this filmmaker is the subject of an oppressive regime. I'm including it because it's an amazing movie. He's really done something ingenious, and he's made the film about himself. At one point, he talks about how he's got this script for his next film. He has been obviously arrested and barred from making the film, but he's going to begin reading it out loud to you on the camera, and then he puts some tape down in his living room and shows you this is what the set would have been. And the guy would have gone through the front door at this point like this and said this line. But I will get thrown in jail if I make a movie. So this is not the movie. This is not the movie. I'm just reading the script and so on. And it just becomes this kind of heroic act of defiance. And that's why it's called This Is Not a Film, because it is not – what you're watching is not a film, because he could get in trouble for that. And then it becomes a very funny – and because he gets off the track of that after a while, and it kind of becomes what he does during his day of being under house arrest and whether he talks to people on the outside and who might come to his door and so on. And it's—I think it's really a remarkable movie, and it was smuggled out of Iran on a thumb drive in a cake, I think, possibly.
By the way, can people come to his door? I haven't seen the film, so can people knock on his door and talk to him?
I don't know if that really was something that could happen, or if it's invented for the movie, because it's not a straight documentary. It's clearly some things that were invented for the film, but. He is now, despite the protests of the world community, he's now in prison.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right, you had a film I disqualified, Margaret, because it came out in 2011. But did it open here in 2000?
You just absolutely said I couldn't. Yeah, it opened in January here. A film by Kenneth Lonergan and starring Anna Paquin as a troubled teenager, but not like any troubled teenager that you've ever seen before, even though you've seen lots of them in movies over the years. And just a sprawling, incredibly well-observed and accurate movie about what this teenage girl goes through after a violent event happens. And she's presented with an ethical dilemma about it, and also how that affects the people and many, many people in her life, and is just so razor sharp and it's a movie that's both kind of, in some strange way, both merciless in the way it looks at people and yet very merciful. And I'm not sure how he did that, Lonergan, but it's really a rich film, and it puts to shame a lot of, you know, relationship movies or whatever you would call
it. That's great. I'm glad that Anna Paquin gets to be in another good movie, because sometimes, you know, you're a young star, you have What was she? The piano?
She won an Oscar for the piano.
Yeah. And then years ago. Who knows what's going to happen to when you win when you're so young.
Right.
So that's great.
And in the years since then, she has sometimes been in kind of an awkward actress, I've thought. But, man, she's incredible in this movie.
That's Margaret. Do you know a fellow named David Butler?
No, I don't.
Well, you and David Butler agree on what the best film of the year is.
Okay.
Once Upon a Time in Anatolia.
Ah, good for him.
Why'd you love this film?
This is a film from Turkey by a director who's had some success in recent years named Nuri Bilge Ceylan. And it takes place mostly in the course of less than a single day, and it's about a police investigation in a rural area. And there's a murder that kind of needs to be solved, and in a way that is something that kind of is the conventional question mark that's raised at the beginning of the movie that allows you to get into it in a way. But then it just becomes about watching these police and suspects go about their duties and philosophical digressions that they have in the course of a very long evening and sizing each other up. And it certainly you get the characters like there's a doctor and a police inspector, and they begin to resemble characters out of a Chekhov play or something. They're so just full of thought and philosophy and, you know, worldviews. And yet, like Chekhov, it's very funny. It's quite an amusing film along the way. And even though you're in this area that looks absolutely ancient, 21st century things intrude, you know, cell phones and things like that.
By the way, do you know, is it available through the various streaming or rental agencies?
Oh, I think it is, because it's been out for a while. It opened earlier this year. Probably showed at film festivals in 2011, but officially opened this year. And it's a spellbinding movie. It's rather long and somewhat slow, but it has enough humor and physical beauty. I mean, it's just gorgeous shot out in this rural area. I think if people are willing to slow down, they will really be entranced by this film.
And Tony in Seattle, he liked Anna Karenina. I'm just going to name – I can't believe how fast this has gone already. I'm just naming that. And then I want to know what you thought of – here's a clip from Moonrise Kingdom.
What kind of bird are you?
I'm a sparrow. She's a dove.
No, I said, what kind of bird are you?
Dear Susie, here's my plan.
Dear Sam, my answer is yes.
Dear Susie, one.
Dear Sam, where?
Dear Susie, walk 400 yards due north from your house to the dirt path which has not got any name on it. Turn right and follow to the end. I will meet you in the meadow.
Did you like that film?
I did like that film.
Bruce Willis was in that.
A bunch of grown-ups.
Bill Murray. Bunch of grown-ups.
Edward Norton. But really, it's about these two kids, and they are the movie. It didn't make my top 10. It will be on my top 20. I wasn't quite – somehow the children were much more fascinating to me than the adults. And right. For me, the movie went a little bit flat when the adults kind of took over.
Adults will do that.
Some straight. Well, that is true. That's a good point.
All right. Now I want to know what you thought of this particular film. Here's a clip.
My dear Frodo, you asked me once if I had told you everything there was to know about my adventures. Well, I can honestly say I have told you the truth. I may not have told you all of it.
Bilbo Baggins, I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
Did you have an adventure with that film?
Was that also from Lincoln?
Yeah, that was from Lincoln.
I don't remember that part. Now, The Hobbit. The Hobbit.
How'd that work for you?
You know, I enjoyed a lot of it, and I didn't enjoy other parts of it. And I'm not quite sure why it was long as it is. So I'm pretty mixed.
Well, that's be three parts. They got to stretch it out.
Yeah. Well, they could have done 2 hours each, I think, made a 6-hour film.
You liked a movie called The Turin Horse.
Yes, which probably a lot of people did not see, but it I think it played for a week at the Northwest Film Forum earlier this year. And it is a film by a Hungarian master filmmaker, really, Béla Tarr. And it is 2.5 hours long. I think it's composed of 30 shots, as opposed to hundreds of shots in most movies. So it is a very deliberate film, and it's about the rhythms of life on this farm. And so you see a lot of repetition because the people on the farm do the same thing every day, and you sense that they have for centuries, you know, in whatever generation you might have happened upon these people. And then you become aware that something that looks suspiciously like the apocalypse might be developing outside as the wind begins to blow and as all some of the rhythms of these two people's lives are begin to break apart. And it's it's frankly the kind of movie that people will either become absolutely spellbound by those repetitions and by this sense of a life that just gets marked out in the same measurements every day, or you will run screaming from the room and just be bored out of your mind, I guess. But I think it's a real achievement, and I think it's kind of a monumental movie. Even though it never leaves this farmhouse and the area, you know, around it, the whole world seems to be marking time and maybe ending
wow.
in the course of the movie.
The Touring Horse. This was the year for Batman, for Bond, for hunting down Bin Laden. But they didn't make your top list. You had The Master, which is an interesting film.
The other Anderson, yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson, not Wes Anderson. Yeah, this is an example of putting a movie on my list because so much of it is so brilliant that I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt, because some of it I did not get. I'm not quite settled on whether this is really a great, great movie or just a movie made by a brilliant filmmaker that has something kind of undigested.
Somebody called it a great failure in some review I read.
Huh. I don't think it's a failure, but it's a very peculiar film.
You also had the movie Amour, the documentary Searching for Sugar Man, which you talked about.
It's very cool. Yeah.
But you have Bernie on your list with Jack Black.
Bernie snuck on there, yes. The Richard Linklater directed a based-on-truth story of a murder, or at least a killing, in a small town in Texas. And the wonderful thing about it, beyond Jack Black's performance, which is great at the center of it, is that there's this Greek chorus of actual residents of this town and its area who I don't think they exactly play themselves, but they are on camera talking about this real-life guy, Bernie. And that makes it really unusual because you can tell they're not actors.
Huh.
You can tell that they're forming this this wonderful kind of in fact, they're much of the movie. Without them, I don't think they could have made the movie.
All right, then. What have you learned? What have you learned about films in 2012, cogitator on
wow.
film?
Well, they're going to just keep making them, Steve. the thing is, I'll say one thing. When I saw The Hobbit, and this is part of my hesitation about it, I did have that feeling that something in my film-going life was changing with this new digital technology, and because what I was looking at did not look like a movie. It looked like something else. It looked like video. It looked like, you know, a variety of different things, because I saw it in a super, super fast format. And all these other digital changes that have been happening, which we have tracked on this show for the last couple of years. And I do have this sense that it's just going to be different from now on. And then in an era of film that was around for 100 years, that might be done. And we might be off into this new area.
Cool. I look forward to talking about
that. That's
what
we'll talk about during the next year.
I look forward to that.
Hopefully.
Robert Horton reviews films for the Herald and Everett. He does the Magic Lantern series at the Fry Art Museum. You can read his work at the Crop Duster. That's his blog. We have links at KOW.org. Happy movies.
You too, Steve.
And now, the sound of the day.
Over the holiday weekend, weekday listener Lynn found an old percolator in the storage closet. She cleaned it up, tried it out. She says the coffee tastes like 1950, but isn't the sound festive? It's one of the many sounds that are going by the wayside as new technologies are created. If you're using some sort of older technology in your daily life, that makes a fine sound of the day. And just like Robert Horton was talking about, changes are coming from film to percolators. We like to take that trip to the past using sound, record 30 seconds, send it to us along with the story behind it, weekday at KUOW.org, put sound of the day in the subject line, and thanks. We'll talk about what happened in Canada. We'll take a look at what happened in business and the economy this last year. It's all coming up on weekday.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age.